From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, how to stop a war through negotiations. We talk with Roger Fisher, director of the Harvard Negotiation Project. While our attention has been fixed on the Gulf War, China has been trying the leaders of the democracy movement. China expert Orville Schell fills us in on the trials and their significance. Also, the Hollywood-Washington connection, how politicians use celebrities to get votes, and what's in it for the celebrities. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Dwight Yoakam's new album, and Maureen Corrigan reviews Wave Me Goodbye, a collection of women's short stories about World War II. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The administration's budget is now in the hands of Congress. Budget Chief Richard Darman unveiled the document today, which he says is the blueprint for a new domestic order. The $1.75 trillion spending plan contains no major initiatives to combat the recession, and it seeks to cut $46 billion from domestic programs over the next 5 years. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Reform was the word Budget Chief Darman used repeatedly this morning to describe the aims of the administration in the 2.5-inch phone book-sized budget for fiscal year 92. But redistribution is more what the plan envisions. The budget seeks more money for education, highway construction, space programs, health care, and the war on drugs. But the amounts are relatively small, and much of the money comes from existing programs. The administration hopes to gain $46 billion in savings over the next 5 years by cutting such government programs as Medicare, student aid, and farm subsidies. Senate Finance Committee Chairman Lloyd Bentsen has already charged that further cuts to Medicare breaks the budget deal struck by Congress and the administration last year. Darman says it's ironic that Democrats who've expressed concern about fairness in the past are reluctant to reduce subsidies for the wealthiest Americans. But House Budget Committee Chairman Leon Panetta says he doesn't have a problem with cutting the benefits of the well-to-do, but he opposes the Bush administration's plan to reduce Medicare in other areas. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
In a briefing today on the president's 1992 budget, Energy Secretary James Watkins announced plans to limit nuclear weapons production and to shift money to cleaning up the environmental problems at weapons plants. NPR's Michael Scholar has details.
The proposed budget is not an overhaul, but it does show a significant shift away from making nuclear weapons. Secretary Watkins announced that the plutonium processing facility in Fernald, Ohio, temporarily closed, will not be reopened. From now on, the only work there will be cleanup. Watkins says the U.S. has all the plutonium it should ever need for weapons, so there are no plans to make more of it. The secretary also said one of three tritium reactors at the Savannah River plant in Georgia will be mothballed, while plans for developing two new tritium reactors will be cut back to one. The main reason for the scale back is that government planners expect arms agreements to dramatically reduce the U.S. nuclear arsenal in the near future. But as funds for making weapons go down, funds for cleaning up the heavily contaminated weapons plants are rising, 19% in the proposed budget. This is Michael Scholar in Washington.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street, bolstered by what analysts say is investor optimism about the Gulf War. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 41 points to close at 2,772.28. Advances led declines by a margin of 7 to 2. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Before the war in the Gulf started, Roger Fisher, the head of the Harvard Negotiation Project, suggested we could avoid war through negotiation. Well, things didn't work out the way Fisher had hoped, but now he's urging both sides to negotiate an end to the war. This morning's news reported that Iran was offering to mediate a settlement. I spoke with Fisher earlier today and asked him if he thought this was an offer worth taking seriously.
I don't think either side would accept a proposal simply because Iran said it was a good idea. I wouldn't ask them to. But a party that is neutral now, if they came up with a package that made sense, wherever it comes from, it doesn't have to be a big power. It doesn't have to be France or the Soviet Union. The Algerians helped us work out the Iranian hostage case 10 years ago. Not because they were powerful, but because they could talk to both sides. people, though, keep thinking a mediator has to be someone like the Pope or someone who has a great deal of legitimacy in the eyes of everybody. I pay more attention to the professional competence of talking and listening and not asking for early commitments, but generating a plan that meets their interests.
Who are you talking to behind the scenes?
I talk to a lot of people in New York at the UN from, I would say, all the countries. I'm saying, let's get a resolution on the table. Don't make any concession, but say, here it is. If they give a commitment to withdraw from Kuwait, a ceasefire will be ordered long enough to permit them to get out. We'll have some observation, a UN commission, or somebody to make sure they're moving in good faith to get out. If they don't, the ceasefire stops. If they do get out, at the end of a period of time, or whenever they're out, within 30, 45 days, whatever it is, all use of force stops, the economic sanctions stop. And then I say that the negotiation of all the other issues, Arab mediation of boundary and islands, something on the Palestinians, and it's a fairly simple package, and you try to make get the bugs out of it.
So this is what you'd like to see the UN do, lay out the
terms. I'd like to see the U.S. support it. We've authorized force if they misbehave. No one has told Iraq what happens if they're good. No one has told them if they say they'll withdraw, what happens? Do they get bombed while they're trying to retreat? Do we attack them as they're getting out? That's a pretty strong deterrent from any steps to get out of Kuwait. So you want to maximize the pressure to get out by saying if you say you'll get out, there's a ceasefire to let you do so. And then you want to maximize the incentive to get out by saying if you get out, the war stops. We can negotiate everything else.
We're perhaps in a transitional period in this war, the period between it being an air war and a ground war. Would this be a good time to start a negotiation?
Oh, I think we want to make it very clear there's a way to stop the war. Even in World War II against Japan, the Potsdam Declaration clarified that unconditional surrender did not mean unconditional slaughter. The Allies stated exactly how to end the war. If you do this, the war will stop. We will have limited occupation. You can import raw materials. The military can live civilian lives. After a period of years, the United States will withdraw as soon as democracy is established. We set the terms, and that made it possible, combined with the military offensive, for Japan to quit. So we did not have to conquer Japan acre by acre the way we did Nazi Germany. The land war will be a disaster. We'll be killing lots of innocent human beings. A lot of our own soldiers will be dying. And for what? A result we don't even want. We don't want to destroy the country. If we go conquer Baghdad, I can see us arriving and the whole situation a mess of the heavy bombing. And we say, who's in charge? And they say, no one. You're in charge. What are you going to do about the wounded and the children and the homeless? What are you going to do about the hungry? What are you going to do about famine and food supplies and disease? And we'll say, oh, dear, why don't you take over? And they say, no, thanks. Unless you guarantee me a $5 billion aid program, I'm not going to be the American puppet here. No, I think that winning that kind of war would be awful. And so I think now is a good time, before any land war starts, to work a way out, a way that we can say is victory for us because they're out of Kuwait, and Saddam Hussein can say, I was not totally defeated. I'm still an important Arab. I can call an Arab reconciliation conference. He can try and deal politically rather than militarily with building himself up.
Do you think our terms for resolution are unclear because our objectives in this war haven't been clearly stated either?
The tendency in a war, as the effort increases, is to increase the objectives. The more we spend in money and human lives trying to pursue the war, the higher a goal we want. I consider land war as though our troops were making yardage on a football field, grinding away a few yards at a time, and the politicians were moving the goalposts further away. We want total victory. We want an end of Saddam Hussein. We want democracy in this country. We would like to have an end of all chemical weapons. We'd like to have security in a new international order. We keep pushing things further and further away, and the troops have to grind and grind on, pursuing objectives that the politicians make. The time to set the terms is now, and if we have unlimited objectives, we will have unlimited war. We want to limit those objectives down to those went in for. Deter aggression, avoid a bad example, liberate Kuwait. Period. We can deal with the rest politically.
As a negotiator, do you ever feel frustrated that maybe the United States doesn't really want to negotiate yet, that what they want to do first, perhaps, is to destroy Iraq's military capability?
There are many people in the United States who do not want to negotiate for two reasons. One, they think of negotiation as giving in. And two, they would like to do more damage before the war ends. I think both are wrong. I think that the damage we do to Iraq is also damage to us. I think we are antagonizing an increasing number of people in that part of the world. We're looking more brutal. We're starting to compete with Saddam Hussein as to who cares less about human life. We're taking him, this most ruthless tyrant I know, and we're saying, we don't care how many of your people we kill. We don't care how many of our own casualties lost. We are prepared to compete with you as to caring less about human life, caring less about loss. That is not a contest I want to enter into. Second, negotiation is not giving in. Negotiation is meeting someone to persuade them. I will negotiate with anybody. I'm more likely to persuade them than they are to persuade me. Are we afraid to negotiate? Do we feel our ideas can't stand up? That somehow if we start talking, we have to stay at the table forever because we cannot explain our position? We cannot clarify what we're doing? I'm really disappointed that the United States has not insisted on negotiation at all times. And even the day the war started, let's insist on meeting in Geneva, continue to talk and work out how this war can stop.
Saddam Hussein may be willing to be a martyr in this war. How do you negotiate with someone who's willing to be
may.
A martyr?
He's going to look at his choices. Right now, he says, if I say I'm losing the war, the Americans will step it up. If I say no, I have an option of better terms. I have an option of fighting on endlessly as they try and conquer acre by acre, and we may last longer than the United States. We may actually win this war if we dig in and hunker down. Americans may lose heart for it. Finally, if that doesn't work, I can be a martyr. I can set the entire Gulf on fire. I can go down in history. I will be an Arab who stood up to the superpower, and they could not impose their will. They just made a mess of it, and the Arab world will be anti-West for a long time. No, I think the martyrdom scenario may be very tempting to him, and that's one reason I want to make it very easy for him to stop the war before he shows us that he can hurt us worse than we think. See, each side has been saying, we can hurt you worse than you think. We've been saying our sophisticated hardware will be more destructive than you expect. And he's saying, my willingness to pollute the environment and set things on fire and destroy people and sacrifice lives, I can do more damage than you think. I'm afraid both of them are right. And the consequence will be disaster unless we use our intelligence, our guts, our openness, our humanity to stop this war and do so as quickly as we can.
Roger Fisher is the director of the Harvard Negotiation Project. Perhaps you've been so busy trying to keep up with events in the Gulf, you've been unable to follow what's been happening in China, where the leaders of the democracy movement have been standing trial. Coming up, China expert Orville Schell fills us in. First, a short break. This is Fresh Air. The war is providing the perfect cover for countries with dirty work to do. While our attention has been focused on the Gulf, the Soviet Union has cracked down on the Baltics. And China has been conducting trials of the democracy movement leaders who were arrested in the spring of 89 after Tiananmen Square. Orville Schell is the author of several books about China, most recently Discos and Democracy, China in the Throes of Reform. We invited Schell to discuss these trials and their significance.
Well, one of the most sort of well-known young student who was recently sentenced to 4 years was Wang Dan. And he was the triumvirate of leaders of the democracy demonstrations in the square. And he was often referred to as the heart of the movement in the sense that He was a rather sensitive, intelligent young student from Beijing University, 22 years old. You have to try to imagine what it's like for a kid of that age to be sort of thrust into a leadership role of this monumental movement with hundreds of thousands of people in the square. And he was picked up shortly after the massacre. There are a number of other people. There are two very interesting, slightly older leaders, Wang Juntao and Chen Zeming, who were the head of a most extraordinary sort of, how to describe it? It was kind of like a liberated zone within China. It was a private research organization that had polling facilities to take opinion polls, had publications, had correspondence schools, it had magazines, book translations. And it was one of China's sort of first and earliest private think tanks in a way. And in this sense, it was enormously threatening to the government because unlike people who might just have wandered into the street with one grievance or another, here was an institution set in the heart of Chinese communist society, which allowed alternative avenues of social mobility. In other words, people could make a living, people could express themselves, people could acquire status, could acquire prestige through this sort of alternate private structure. So we should watch for Wang Juntao and Chen Zeming very carefully, because within their sentence, we will also see a judgment on this very interesting new development in Chinese communist society of a civil society. In other words, of people outside of the official sort of embrace of the Chinese Communist Party. And it was this, you see, that led up to the demonstrations, and it made the demonstrations more than just a few people protesting. It made it an expression of an alternate power center that was challenging the Communist Party and in effect, beginning to make China into a pluralist society.
You know, one thing that I read about Wang Dan, who you had mentioned, the 22-year-old student leader, he's number one on the police list of most wanted students. I'd read that he'd cooperated with the authorities, and that gave him the permission to read in his prison cell, but that his reputation in China was declining because of his cooperation with authorities. What could you tell us about that?
Well, I've heard similar rumors. It's very hard to know, but one thing which we can say is this: that the more famous a prisoner is, namely, the more well-known he is in the outside world, the lighter he tends to be treated within China itself in the penal system. This is a kind of a curious phenomenon, that if someone is respected or known abroad, then he acquires a respect and luster within China itself. So there's a curious process that goes on of sort of co-optation through light treatment of the very people that the government knows will have some impact when they get out because they are well known. What we really, I think, need to worry about are those people whose names we don't know, or whose names are known but who are not famous and who there's very little agitation or support for. So Wang Dan, in a way, is a kind of a celebrity prisoner. And I think, you know, it is this that our government sometimes doesn't appreciate, namely the power they have in affording some measure of protection to people in China who have been detained or arrested, people who really have no protection, either legal or otherwise, within their own country.
What can you tell us about the language of the charges that are being brought against the people on trial? I mean, everybody seems to be accused of being a counter-revolutionary, which has this really old-time hard-line ring to it.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. I mean, they speak of the black hands of counter-revolutionary instigators. These dreary, sort of old-fashioned Marxist allegations. It's as if their imagination has failed them, and they really don't know what else to do. They're stuck in this rhetorical time warp. But you know, on the other hand, Terry, I must say that much has changed in China. And we must not assume from this rather retarded phraseology that they use that we've been plunged back here into the Cultural Revolution again. In fact, China has been hooked up to the outside world. The outside world does have enormous impact on what goes on there in terms of its sort of appraisals of that country and how Chinese react to it. And also, China has broken apart. The old ideology has fallen. No one believes in it anymore. And if there was one thing that really impressed me about the last trip I made to China in November, it was that even though on the surface one finds people very numb and quite submissive and more or less just waiting for some old leader to die, underneath there is a cauldron of cynicism and mockery for their leadership. And what this suggests to me that although the rhetoric has snapped back to the 60s or 70s, and although on the surface there's a curious socialist calm, and intellectually speaking the country is dead as a doornail, underneath there is a whole new sort of psychological environment in which people dare to project their grievances outward against the government rather than inward against themselves, which was the model of the past, namely that if you were accused by the government, the tendency was to believe that you were wrong and to try to find the out damn spot, to find the spot within yourself, to join the government in attacking yourself. And this sort of overweening desire to reintegrate yourself back into society with mea culpas, now you don't find that. Now you find people speaking just in the most abusive fashion about these octogenarians, about this failed ideology, and about this sort of collapsed system, which is propping itself up perforce of arms rather than perforce of a belief system.
But when you hear people speaking out against the government, are you talking about hearing them in private places or in public places?
In private places. But this is very significant because, 10, 15 years ago, people wouldn't dare speak out in private. Not only that, I think in a lot of cases, people didn't even have these kinds of subversive thoughts. And I think this is the real effect of the democracy movement of 1989, is that it has changed the climate, the intellectual and the psychological climate of the country, where people dare to think dissenting thoughts, where they dare to be independent. And what we've seen is this recrudescence of a private world, a world which did not exist before because it was too fearful. We see a society that has begun to develop margins, both intellectually and economically. I mean, we have private enterprise still everywhere. So this means that people can escape from the center. They can retreat, sort of like Robin Hood, with his merry band, off into the protection of Sherwood Forest. There are Sherwood Forests everywhere in China today. Perhaps not so many politically speaking as there are economically. But this means that people can find havens outside of the central control of the government. And again, this is what has been most threatening to the party, and this is why they have treated these prisoners so severely and why they are so ambivalent about, all these signs of capitalism that they themselves are cultivating because they need it to produce, to have a healthy economy.
What are the vulnerabilities of the leadership now in China?
Well, I guess the most obvious one is age. I mean, you have Deng Xiaoping, who's, 86. You have Wang Jun, the vice president, who I never can quite remember how old he is. He's so old. He's heading towards 90. You have Yang Shangkun, who's in his high 80s. He's president. You have any number of people who have not even been seen in public because they can't walk. And this is, creates the climate. There's an expression in Chinese of listening to the blathering dreams of octogenarians, and this is sort of the attitude towards these people. Why don't they let go? I mean, why are they hanging on? And how can a country be possibly led by people who have faded off into senility and are physically unable even to rise from the bed?
How do you think the Gulf War is affecting China now and affecting China's diplomatic relations with the United States?
Well, as you know, after announcing that we would not meet with any high-ranking officials from China, George Bush in December met with a foreign minister. This was after the Chinese deigned to abstain from that Security Council vote, which allowed the United States to contemplate the use of force on January 15th. This was our payment to China. So China has really had a field day, sort of rehabilitating itself on the international front. It's a little, China reminds me a little bit of Richard Nixon in the sense that, you know, in each case there are high crimes and misdemeanors behind the screen, but in each case neither Nixon or China have been able to admit to this fact. They go on as if nothing has happened, as if they can kind of act out the form of a responsible, intelligent citizen that people will forget. And Iraq and the Persian Gulf situation have allowed China to play this, to act out this role of being a responsible world power, and to send their foreign minister around and to say they don't believe in the use of force, which, by the way, was the reason why they said they abstained from the Security Council resolution. So they have, whether they have succeeded or not, I can't say, but they hope they've succeeded in a public relations campaign to rehabilitate themselves in the eyes of the world as a stable, responsible world actor.
Orville Schell, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Journalist Orville Schell, his latest book is Discos and Democracy, China in the Throes of Reform. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the Hollywood-Washington connection. Ronald Brownstein discusses his new book on how Washington politicians use Hollywood celebrities and vice versa. Also, Ken Tucker reviews a new album by country music singer Dwight Yoakam. And Maureen Corrigan reviews Wave Me Goodbye, a book of short stories by women about women on the home front during World War II. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Iran has offered to help work out an end to the Persian Gulf War. Iranian President Rafsanjani says that he is ready to meet with Iraqi President Saddam Hussein and also to talk to U.S. officials about proposals for peace, adding that creating security in the area without securing Iran's views is not possible. Iran has officially taken no sides in the Persian Gulf War. But in Washington, a White House spokesman said that he saw little hope for such talks. Thousands of people in Norfolk, Virginia, returned to their homes this evening after authorities defused six explosive devices at a chemical tank farm. Art Williamson of member station WHRV has more.
It was a bomb scare in the city which houses the largest U.S. naval facility in the world. City, state, and federal authorities in Norfolk monitored two explosive devices throughout the day until those devices were defused. A Norfolk City spokesperson says one device with a single detonator had two pipe bombs attached, and that was connected to a storage tank containing 1 million gallons of highly explosive methanol, a solvent. A short time later, another device, this one with four pipe bombs attached, was discovered hooked up to a storage tank containing 1 million gallons of caustic sodium sulfate. The bombs were found at a tank farm on the Elizabeth River. Spokesmen at the Norfolk Naval Base say that facility is secure and that no special precautions were taken. Authorities say they currently have no idea who planted the bombs. For National Public Radio, this is Art Williamson in Norfolk, Virginia.
Israel's defense ministry has agreed to cut by 3 months the detention time of a leading Palestinian activist who was arrested last week on charges of spying for Iraq. Patricia Golan reports that a court in Jerusalem found the state's request for a 6-month-long detention not justified by the evidence.
Last week, Israel's Minister of Defense asked that Sarin Yuseba be put away for 6 months' administrative detention, an emergency regulation that allows a suspect to be jailed without trial. The Israeli authorities said at the time that to formally charge him in court would mean revealing sensitive intelligence sources. The authorities claim they had evidence that Nuseiba, a philosophy professor at Birzeit University on the West Bank, had provided Iraq with precise information as to where the Scud missiles launched by Iraq are landing. Nuseiba is a leading spokesman for the Palestinians and a supporter of the PLO. His detention caused an uproar both in Israel and abroad. Critics said that for such a serious crime as espionage, he should be put on trial and allowed to defend himself, and charged that he was arrested for political reasons. For National Public Radio, this is Patricia Golan in Jerusalem.
Police in Jerusalem say that the offices of British Airways in the Arab section of the city were set on fire today. There were no reports of injuries, but there was extensive damage. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 41 points to close at 2,772.28. This is NPR News. According to reports from Jordan, refugees who have crossed the border from Iraq say that Allied bombing of Basra is forcing residents to get their drinking water from street puddles. The refugees also said that Allied bombing has gutted the main roads to the city. In New York City, the UN Secretary General has condemned Allied bombing raids of the highway from Baghdad to Amman, and he called Jordan an innocent victim of the Persian Gulf War. In South Africa, court is adjourned for the day in the kidnapping and assault trial involving Winnie Mandela, the wife of African National Congress Deputy President Nelson Mandela. Winnie Mandela and seven others face charges stemming from the alleged beating of four youths in the Mandela home in 1988. Defense attorneys have asked that the charges be dropped because the prosecution has not provided enough evidence. Colin Blaine of the BBC reports from Johannesburg.
Mrs. Winnie Mandela's legal counsel spent much of the first day in court disputing the validity of the charges against her. Mrs. Mandela is represented by Mr. George Bezos, the veteran advocate who helped defend Nelson Mandela when he was jailed for treason nearly 30 years ago. Mr. Bezos insists that the prosecution's charges are vague and unfair. He says Mrs. Mandela has a right to know precisely what she's accused of and when and where it's supposed to have happened. He wants the charges against Mrs. Mandela quashed, although if the judge agrees, new charges could be laid. Counsel for the three other accused in the dock have made similar submissions. Part of the difficulty the prosecution faces is that four men, who are also accused of kidnap and assault, have skipped bail. A warrant's been issued for their arrest.
Colin Blaine of the BBC reporting from Johannesburg. In trading today in overseas markets, the dollar moved higher. Gold prices also moved up. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Later on the show, the power connection between Hollywood celebrities and Washington politicians. Country singer Dwight Yoakam has a new album called If There Was a Way. Rock critic Ken Tucker says Yoakam is setting the standard for country music today.
Take a map of the world and measure with your hand all of the miles across all of the land. Write it down, add it up, you might understand about the distance between you and me. Yeah, the distance between.
To understand why I've admired Dwight Yoakam without really liking him, just look at the back of his new album. There's Dwight, his ever-present cowboy hat pushed down over his eyes, his mouth turned down in a sour expression. He's leaning against a wire mesh fence with his arms raised and stretched out. There's no doubt about it, he's crucifying himself for you, a grateful audience now obliged to worship him. In the past, Dwight Yoakam has seemed arrogant, sullen, obnoxious, derivative, and so full of himself that it was hard to hear past his overweening pride. All that said, country music hasn't produced a song as lovely as this one in a long, long time.
I pay rent on a rundown place. There ain't no view, but there's lots of space in my heart. The heart that you own. I paid the rent, paid right on time. Baby, I pay you every single dime from my heart. The heart that you own. Used to be I could love here for free way back before you bought the property. Now I pay daily on what once was mine. Lord, I probably owe you for these tears that I cried.
That's The Heart You Own, written by Yoakam. His 1988 album Buenas Noches from a Lonely Room was a thoroughly mean-spirited little record, featuring a song cycle about romantic betrayal that peaked with Dwight murdering his lover without a heck of a lot of remorse. He'd never seemed so cynical. Yoakam was born in Columbus, Ohio, and raised in Pikeville, Kentucky, and has made his reputation as country music's most articulate neoconservative, bad-mouthing Nashville legends like Chet Atkins and promoting unfashionable singers like Buck Owens. Yoakam seemed less like a rebel than a phony. What, you kept thinking, was this guy's problem? But on his new album, Yoakam earns his moodiness with beautiful honky-tonk compositions such as Nothing's Changed Here.
I hear you walking. Same old time.
a way, the current situation in country music makes Dwight Yoakam look even better than he might otherwise. The genre is dominated these days by stiffs. There's no denying the musical talents of people like Clint Black, Randy Travis, and Mary Chapin Carpenter, but there's also no doubt that these are bland, colorless performers. Dwight Yoakam, with his bad attitude and his defensive posture, has come to seem nearly heroic. While everyone around him is assiduously making well-crafted, pretty music, he's doing things like bringing the blues back to country music in the title song of this album.
I was just thinking of myself, how I still want you, oh, nobody else. Oh, I was just thinking, I was just thinking all to myself, oh, all to myself.
Yoakam's crucial collaborator on If There Was a Way is its lead guitarist and producer, Pete Anderson, who's been with Yoakam from the start. Anderson's arrangements give Yoakam's callow bravado a gravity and conviction that it wouldn't have otherwise. Together, Yoakam and Anderson have made the country album that everyone else is going to have to scramble to catch up to.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly.
You couldn't tell it by the smile, but my recovery took a while. I worked for days and nights on end, just to walk and talk again. You can't believe the time it takes to heal a heart once it breaks. The only time I feel the pain is in the sunshine of the rain. I don't feel no hurt at all. Unless you count when teardrops fall.
This is Fresh Air. Let me share an ongoing dilemma we face in lining up guests for Fresh Air. We want a certain rock star to be on the show. And we're told, oh, he'll be happy to be on the show, but only to talk about his favorite cause, the rainforest. Or the same will happen with a celebrity actor. Yes, they'll be a guest, but what they really want to talk about is their recent fact-finding trip to Nicaragua. More celebrities than ever seem to have adopted causes, and more politicians than ever seem to have adopted celebrities. Warren Beatty was in Gary Hart's camp, Arnold Schwarzenegger in George Bush's. Ronald Brownstein is the author of a new book about the connection between Hollywood celebrities and Washington politics. It's called The Power and the Glitter. Early in the 1988 presidential campaign, Brownstein started writing about how candidates build a financial base. His research led him to Hollywood, where he attended many fundraising parties.
One night in the course of doing this research, I went to a dinner at a home of one of the young political activists on the west side of Los Angeles, and there were all sorts of people there from Hollywood and the political community. And as we were sitting around this table talking about this whole phenomenon, I realized about halfway through that even though I lived in Washington, I was the only person in that room who had not been to Ted Kennedy's house. And I said, huh. Something is going on here. And as I began to research the book, what I realized was that, you know, we tend to write stories every 4 years about how Hollywood has discovered politics. But as I began to do the research on the book, I mean, I found that there was this incredibly rich history there going all the way back to the 1920s.
Do you think that stars are courted by politicians according to what the star symbolizes? For instance, when George Bush was running for president, one of the things he was supposed to be overcoming in his image was, you know, the wimp.
Mm-hmm.
So who does he get in his camp? Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yes, and Chuck Norris as well. They do something else that's very interesting. That you know, in talking to Lee Atwater, I talked to Atwater at length for writing the book, and you know, he talked, I think, quite explicitly about the fear of Bush being portrayed by the Democrats as this elitist preppy wimp, this blue blood from Connecticut, and they were very conscious of the cultural box that the Democrats were trying to erect around them with the Ann Richards speech at the convention. You may remember, you know, poor George, born born with a silver foot in his mouth and all of this. And one of the ways they wanted to get out of that was by stressing the West Texan Main Street beef jerky side of George Bush. They did that in part by surrounding him with country and Western stars. I mean, just about every other day on the campaign trail, George Bush had some country and Western group, you know, some pedal steel guitarist around him. And it reached its apogee, I think, when they sent him campaigning through Illinois on a bus with Loretta Lynn and Crystal Gayle. And there's this image of this son of a senator from Connecticut sitting in the back of a bus with Loretta Lynn and Crystal Gayle strumming a guitar.
Here's what I've never been able to figure out. How did George Bush get Arnold Schwarzenegger in his camp? And I ask that knowing that Schwarzenegger's married to Maria Shriver. And isn't Shriver the daughter of Sergeant Shriver, who was in the Kennedy administration, Democratic lineage?
We have the Austrian black sheep of the Kennedy clan here, Schwarzenegger. Well, Schwarzenegger is emerging as the preeminent conservative spokesman in Hollywood. But in the 80s, as I talk about in the book, Charlton Heston was forced to be the spokesman on virtually everything. I mean, he was the one defending Reagan. He was the one fighting gun control. He was the one debating Paul Newman on Nightline about the nuclear freeze. I mean, one of the low moments, by the way, in the history of the relationship between Hollywood and politics is having the nuclear freeze debated by Charlton Heston and Paul Newman. But nonetheless, Heston had to be everywhere, largely because there were virtually no other leading conservatives willing to get out there and take a stand on issues for Republicans. What's happening now is that Schwarzenegger, as in some ways the biggest box office draw in the world, at least Time Magazine has told us that, is increasingly willing to get out there himself. I mean, he's spending a lot of time at the White House with Bush. He's going out there and speaking for a variety of conservative causes. And I think that in the next few years, Schwarzenegger will emerge, unlikely as it seems, as a visible figure in Republican circles. He will supplant Heston as the right's principal spokesman in Hollywood.
Can you give us a sense of how politicians court the star that they want to use for their campaign?
Yeah, I think politicians really spend more time courting the Hollywood fundraisers than they do the Hollywood stars themselves. The politicians mostly depend on intermediaries to actually deliver the stars. The most dramatic trend that I think you see in the 70 years of this relationship is the growing sense of importance in Hollywood. I mean, these people increasingly believe that it is entirely appropriate that the people who want to be president should pass through their living rooms first. In the 1988 presidential campaign, Norman Lear and a group of very wealthy liberal Democrats sort of established themselves as a rump group and announced that they expected all of the Democrats to come by for their approval before they would help them. And in fact, dutifully, one by one, each of the Democrats who wanted to be president presented themselves for inspection to this group of wealthy Hollywood liberals. I mean, that suggests that something is a little bit out of whack here in where the relationship has gone, that, Louis Mayer in the 1920s besieged Herbert Hoover. Jack Warner and Daryl Zanuck, I mean, they wanted to be invited to the White House. They wanted to be accepted by FDR. They wanted the social validation that politicians could bestow. Now it's really become the opposite. I mean, the people in Hollywood sort of view themselves as more serious and more worthy than these flighty, money-obsessed politicians and really give them a pretty bad time.
What's in it for politicians to have Hollywood stars behind them?
Well, there are really two things, money and attention. Money is the most tangible and the most dramatic and the most compelling reason why politicians go to Hollywood. It is clearly an important stop on the national money hunt. The second thing is that stars draw the media, and politicians can use them to attract attention to their own campaigns and their own causes.
What's in it for the stars who affiliate with political causes or with politicians?
I think stars are attracted to it on two levels. On the one hand, politics offers them an opportunity to present themselves as serious people. You know, when I was talking to Robert Redford in the course of writing the book, and he said, you know, Hollywood figures, people in Hollywood often feel like what they do is shallow and insubstantial, and politics offers them a way to say, look, I'm not really this piece of fluff that you see five nights a week on reruns. I'm really a serious person. I care deeply about the world, and I have all of these thoughts. The second thing that politics does for stars is it allows them to focus their celebrity on their own aims. I think that's really important. Stars like being famous because it makes them rich, but they don't like being famous because of the 200 paparazzi taking pictures of them every time they get out of their house. The prosaic demands of fame can be very demanding and oppressive at times. politics allows them to take that glare of celebrity, that fame, and to sort of turn it on its head, use it for their own aims. I think they find that very attractive.
Sometimes really confusing things happen, like when Jessica Lange made the movie about the plight of small farmers. Mm-hmm. She ended up testifying to Congress about small farmers. Right. And you figure, okay, no matter how much she really believes in this cause, I mean, is she the most credible spokesperson because of the 3 months of research she perhaps did for the movie?
Yeah, the image of Jessica Lange and Sissy Spacek and Jane Fonda testifying on farm problems really exemplifies the problem. I mean, the problem is not so much that Hollywood figures get out there and talk about what they don't know about. I mean, that's lamentable, but a lot of people do that in our society. The real problem is that the way our debate has been trivialized, the way that the competition for those 15 seconds on the evening news, the soundbite, has come to define our politics, it's entirely logical for causes and candidates to try to attract the camera with these stars. And that leads you into these kind of absurd situations, like a House committee inviting Jessica Lange to talk about life on the farm.
Are you very cynical about the relationship between celebrities and politicians?
No, I'm not entirely cynical about it. I mean, I think there are many people, many celebrities who get out there and just want to see their name in the paper or are just so intoxicated with their own celebrity, really, just so happy to hear their own voice that they'll talk about anything. I think there are a number of others, though, who are simply in politics, get involved in politics, because they're trying to figure out something rational to do with this enormous spotlight that follows them around, this enormous platform with which they've been handed. And strangely enough, I found this to be most poignant in some of the younger celebrities who can say and do some of the dumbest things, but also, I think, in many cases, get into politics because they're trying to send out a message to their very young fans that it is important to be engaged in the society, that it's that, you know, that just being cool and having an attitude and sort of turning everything out, tuning everything out, isn't really the way to go. So, no, I'm not entirely cynical about it. I think there are a lot of people who are involved out of the best of motives, even if it doesn't always turn out in practice to be the best of decisions for them to be involved.
Well, Ronald Brownstein, thanks very much for talking with us.
All right, thanks for having me.
Ronald Brownstein is a national political correspondent for the L.A. Times. His new book is called The Power and the Glitter. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. President Bush's budget goes to Capitol Hill. We'll have several reports. An update on the U.S. Air Sky West collision Friday night at Los Angeles. Jim Muir, Neil Conan, and Scott Simon report on the state of affairs in the Persian Gulf War. And I'll be talking with some people in Cleveland, Tennessee, about their memories of wartime, the Second World War, and the Vietnam War. Also a conversation with Deborah Winger about her new film, The Sheltering Sky, which was made from the Paul Bowles book of that name, filmed on location in North Africa. And we'll also be talking about Deborah Winger's most famous uncredited movie role.
And you won't tell us what. Okay, that and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our critic Maureen Corrigan has been reading a World War II anthology of women's stories. And in spite of everything that's changed for women between then and now, she finds these stories relevant for women and men today.
When the hardcover edition of Wave Me Goodbye was published last year, editor Ann Boston warned readers in her introduction that the stories were like relics from a lost civilization. The era of bombing raids, blackouts, and gas masks, she said, now seemed light years away. Well, a paperback edition of Wave Me Goodbye has just been published. And now it's Boston's introduction that seems dated, while the stories she's collected have become poignantly topical. These days, women can experience war firsthand, and men can experience the anxiety of being left behind. Oddly enough, I think these changes mean that a collection like Wave Me Goodbye will mean something to more people. These stories were originally addressed to women on the home front. But now all of us, women and men, who are watching the war, should discover some startling correspondences in these accounts of how an earlier wartime generation coped. Wish Me Luck As You Wave Me Goodbye is the full title of a jaunty World War II song, and Boston says it gives you an idea of the stoic role women were expected to play. A fond farewell to the menfolk, and then on with the battle on the home front. Boston combed through British and American magazines published between 1939 and 1949 to find stories that would flesh out and even contradict this official image. There are stories here by some of the finest women writers of the time: Olivia Manning, Elizabeth Bowen, Sylvia Townsend Warner, and Jan Struther, who wrote the Mrs. Miniver series. Some stories, like Molly Panter Downs's Goodbye, My Love, record the awful dread of impending separation. A young wife named Ruth tries to freeze the minutes in the 2 days before her soldier husband leaves. But Downs writes that the one clock in their flat went on sucking time like an endless string of macaroni into its bright, vacant face. Other writers deal with an ugly truth about war. That is, as long as you're safe and no one you know is doing the fighting, war can sometimes even be exciting. Marjorie Sharp's comic story, Night Engagement, describes how a young woman named Doris takes advantage of the London Blitz to meet marriageable men in bomb shelters. And in Edna Ferber's story, Grandma Isn't Playing, the heroine Anna changes from a listless old woman to a Rosie the Riveter, glowing with her new purpose in life. But leave it to acid-tongued, brave Dorothy Parker to reveal one of the nastiest wartime secrets: that sometimes there's an envy of those people who get to escape the ordinary routine into the intensity of the battlefield. In Parker's The Lovely Leave, a wife named Mimi shouts at her pilot husband, "You have a whole new life. I have half an old one." Maybe the profoundest insight in this collection comes from Elizabeth Bowen. She said, "All wartime writing is resistance writing," meaning it's a way for the interior life to put up resistance to the annihilating effects of war. As TV numbs us with images of this new war, literature gives us a way to fight back.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed Wave Me Goodbye, edited by Anne Boston. Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers are Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, Dan Lachlan, and Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the psychological toll of combat. Ray Scurfield, assisted psychiatrist in Vietnam. Now he works with vets suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. Also, we talk with Mohammed Mehedi of the National Council on Islamic Affairs. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.